Ensign Boimler to Cerritos, 2 for emergency treatment.
Oh! Ugh.
Are you insane?
We can't just beam out of here. These guys need that animal.
Even if it eats us?
General Order 5!
Fine, okay, how about we stun it? We'll just stun it.
No, that could spoil the milk.
Spoil what milk?
These guys probably milk it.
Oh, like you even know.
Ooh, take off your pants.
Mariner.
Five shifts, Yeti shoes, I am always right. Take them off now!
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton eating hardly any flesh.
And this week we are going to talk about the first episode of the latest Star Trek animated series, Lower Decks, and that episode is Second Contact.
Yeah, Cam, of course, we have them kind of set up the entire premise in the title right there. This is a ship, the Cerritos, that specializes in second contacts. I think as an entry point, you've got the main character, one Brad Boimler. He's kind of setting up everything like you would hope that they do. You've got the exterior of the ship. It looks beautiful. I like the design there. You jump into the bridge. You set up the top dogs. And then you actually kind of pull the rug from underneath of yours and that they finally understand what is going on. You are following the people at the bottom of the ship, the ones that are supposed to be fixing the replicators from shooting out bananas, hot bananas at you. I think this is how you kind of set up a series like this. Star Trek's first ever comedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very simple premise, but one that I think we take for granted because, of course, we've watched the episode Lower Decks. Of course, we know what that means. But I think for a new viewer who hasn't watched Star Trek, it sets it up very quickly and efficiently.
And I think the thing for me, though, is just the stakes. We've been dealing with both on Star Trek Picard as well as Discovery. Every season, it's about the end of the universe. I like it if the stakes are, well, I don't know. Is somebody going to go on a date with somebody aboard the ship? Is it going to be a good date? Is somebody going to be able to dish out some dirt on an insubordinate colleague to the captain? Is a zombie apocalypse going to overtake the crew? Well, maybe we're getting to Discovery territory. Maybe that was an Alex Kurtzman note to creator Mike McMahon. But I don't know. It's me. I like the stakes of the series in that it seems more of kind of that hangout factor that we love so much about all our favorite Star Trek shows.
Yeah, and that is something that Discovery, I feel like Discovery has that hangout factor, but often pulls itself away from that. Whereas Picard, we're not quite there yet. But I do like that this show seems pitched to be the hangout factor show.
Yeah. I would argue, though, Discovery has its moments of hangout, but it's not really a hangout show. I would not the way that you could point to other episodes, or I should say other series in the franchise. Cam, the main titles. I dig the theme song. Unlike the Discovery and the Picard theme songs, which didn't really stick in my head as soon as they premiered, but I can remember them now. I like this one. It has kind of that classic vibe, almost kind of that 70s sort of vibe that you'd think from like a Johnny Quest show or something like that. But you're also seeing like just funny things that also set up the premise of the show, in that the Cerritos is getting sucked into a black hole. It's running into comets. It's running away from Borg attacks, and aliens even like to suck on their warp nacelles. It's a good way to set up the series premise as well.
Yeah, some foreshadowing for the episode as well. But I enjoyed this opening a lot. In fact, I was making notes being like, why is this the best opening in any of the Kurtzman Star Treks? Because I have not really been a fan of the Discovery openings. I don't really know what they're going for at this point with the animation and the music that's fairly generic. And the Picard one, I mean, it made more sense, I think, thematically when you watch the visuals of that opening, but it's not exciting. Whereas this one, I was like, it's vivid, it's vibrant. I see the possibilities of what the Star Trek galaxy offer out there in this opening, as well as, you know, musical tones that touch on a little bit of the 1970s animated series as well. And I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic opening.
Well, one of the things that I think is very important for, you know, Star Trek to do is establish the characters, the people that we're going to be following throughout this. I think obviously Mariner and Boimler are the top two. They obviously have kind of like a dynamic. It's not exactly best friends in the world, especially with how willing Boimler is to, rat on Mariner. But I do like the dynamic here. I do like spending time with these characters, which is something that you want to have right out of the gate for a new show.
Is there a comparison you can think of in the franchise that these two maybe line up with? Like, is it a little bit of a Bones and Spock or a Quark and Odo?
I would say even maybe the first, five episodes of Discovery with Saru and Burnham. You know, they had that dynamic initially, but it's definitely more playful than that. Maybe it's more along the Spock and Bones line, as you alluded to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was we've talked in the past about how Kurtzman shows tend to move very quickly. At least Discovery certainly did initially. And in this animated show, I mean, animated series do move, more quickly just by nature. And this was a very speedy introduction to the characters. I thought it did it fairly well and nailed down at least the two personalities that mattered the most for this episode, which are your two leads with Mariner and Boimler. I thought they did a good job in establishing exactly who they were in about, 30 seconds?
Well, do you want to spend more time with these two characters, getting to know them in the episodes to come?
Do I have a choice? yes, I do. I'm totally into hang out with these characters more.
Yeah, so I think that they were successful there. You get into more of the peripheral characters. I think it's great that we've got an Orion woman that we're able to follow as a Starfleet officer. You and I had always long speculated that the Orions were just in fact kind of like solid folks. It's just we've been witnessing the dregs of them as part of the Orion Syndicate, and it's nice to see some representation in the form of Tendi there. And look, with an animated show, look, you can budget it however you want. It's going to cost the same, right? So we get to go visit the Orion, homeworld for the very first time, just because through the holodeck at least, just because it's an animated series.
Do you think the reason we never had an Andorian regular is because they didn't want to have to paint an actor every single episode?
Well, I don't think they care about that. Look at
you're right, with Neelix and stuff Phillips. Like that. Yeah.
I think maybe here they were drawn to the idea that they've just never had an Orion character before, and I think that's kind of a fun opportunity for them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's cool. And then we also have Rutherford, the guy with. It's just a funny concept. He's a new cyborg. His appliances keep malfunctioning. He's on a date, and you've got a Vulcan implant that's suppressing emotions at random. Like, I was having fun watching that guy spend the entire high-tension, episode kind of going on this date. They were still, talking about music, holding hands, that sort of stuff. Like, that was kind of a fun idea as well. Just, establishing those lower stakes going on in Lower Decks.
Well, we've seen that sort of material in the past in, Someone to Watch Over Me with 7 of 9 on dates. And it was fun to see a little bit of a different tack taken on it, a little more of a high-pressure situation. And again, it was introducing a situation that's recognizable, but letting us learn about the characters through that situation. And I think that's always a good thing to do, because if you introduce your character and drop them in the middle of an episode where it's something like the Royale, the TNG episode that's so convoluted and weird, it's very tough to get a grasp on character because you're trying to figure out the situation, whereas this just comes naturally.
And it makes sense. So, their first episode is dedicated to a second contact. And if that's what they specialize in, I like it when we get to see our characters doing their jobs and seeing how those jobs are different between, whoever is in the command crew and whoever is down in the lower decks. And it was cool to kind of see that jerk of a first officer. Now, I don't know if he really is a jerk or if it's just maybe the perceptions that the Lower Decks characters have of the guy, but look, he gets that bug bite. It unleashes a 28 Days Later sort of movie afterwards, and things go from there.
See, I was thinking Impulse the whole time with the zombie Vulcans.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what they're going for, but who's to say
that? It just reminded me a lot of that, but it was a little bit of more 28 Days Later kind of thing with the fast moving zombie type stuff. I wondered that as well in terms of the number one character, the Commander Ransom. and that when you watch that original episode, Lower Decks from TNG, I can't say Riker comes off the greatest in that episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do wonder if this was just their take on how do we have a lot of fun with a Riker type.
Well, I think the very important relationship that we need to touch on, though, is Captain Freeman and Ensign Mariner. We find out at the end of the episode that Mariner is, in fact, Freeman's daughter, and Freeman's at the point where she's insubordinate. She just wants dirt on her daughter so she can get rid of her on the ship. She's even willing to throw her on the brig until the admiral slash, you know, husband, father is like, no, you got to deal with this. I like the dynamic. I don't think it's super realistic, but we're talking about a sci-fi series in which a giant insectoid suckles on our main character for an extended period of time and gives an antidote to some sort of like zombie sort of disease. So I can suspend my disbelief, but I like the dynamic, that the potential behind that dynamic that those two characters can share with each other.
Well, I also just like the wanting to send her to the brig. It's like, no, she loves the brig.
Yeah. Well, okay. You brought up a funny moment. Like, there's like, we had talked about it last week in our prelude to the series about how it's not like I'm looking for like guffaws as I watch this. I'm mostly just looking for an enjoyable time, whether I like spending time with these characters, work with them as they build this universe, etc. There were a couple moments that made me laugh, though. I'm an easy laugh. Freeman calling Boimler Bumford, that just made me laugh. Like I'm a cheap laugh like that. The other moment that really got a laugh out of me is when they visited the holodeck and they're like, you know, Boimler, just show us whatever you fancy. What's the greatest thing you can imagine right now? He says, computer, show me the warp core. I got a laugh out of that. So they had these like small moments, and those are the moments that I like, as opposed to like hit you over the head with like a punchline sort of stuff.
I kind of like the moment too, where she makes the reference to the giant spider having milk. And then later on, the alien shows up and goes, hey, it'll spoil the milk.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, oh, here's a moment I think you would also like, though, is when she's listing off all these main characters that we know and love. She's like, you know, Worf, you know, Deanna Troi, what about Gary Mitchell? No. It's
just like, I clapped like a seal at that moment. I was so excited to hear Gary Mitchell's name thrown out there.
Is that the first time he's been referenced since Where No Man Has Gone Before?
Yeah. I mean, they toyed, I know, with ideas of working him into one of the Kelvinverse movies very briefly.
Yeah.
But they always just said they could never figure out a way to make a guy named Gary Mitchell sound cool. So it just got passed over. But yeah, no, I was excited. Any mention of Gary Mitchell is a great thing in my eyes.
Maybe they could have just called him Mitch or Mitchell the entire time. You know, they didn't have to drop a Gary bomb on us.
I guess it's, you know, when you look at what that Kurtzman era wanted to do with villains, though, it's like Crawl, Khan, Gary. Or even just Mitchell.
Yeah.
You're like, well, you know, I don't know. It's not that great, really.
Yeah.
I get it.
Totally understandable there. There's just all these like little small moments, like seeing the woman in like the Geordi LaForge visor. We also had that Benzites with the apparatus for breathing in the atmosphere of the ship. You know, it's like those little nods. They don't have to hit you over the head. I love it if it's just in the background.
Well, even just seeing like a Bajoran on the bridge, or a Trill who he's out on the date with, like a lot of just alien species thrown in all over the place. And of course, my beloved Kashian, Doctor, you know, having all these different alien species worked throughout the entire fabric of the show. And I know I've already seen online the classic Star Trek fans online being like, this isn't Star Trek, which whatever, that's a whatever. But, you know, so often, I think fans want to see more Star Trek aliens. And here's a show that actually has the opportunity to do that and is embracing it.
Yeah. Could you imagine if like we were watching the series premiere of Next Generation and they decided to have a giant insectoid, like try to eat some of our characters. Like think about how hokey that would look, but like, yeah. Animation, just go with it. It works for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like this show, I can never say they didn't try to do as much as they could with the animation form, because that was always, I think, a bit of a frustration with the original animated series, in that it was obviously done on the cheap. And it did have some amazing visuals with, you know, aliens we've referenced on this podcast. But when you actually watch a show, there's a lot of static animation just because they didn't have money. Whereas you could really tell, you know, we've jumped a long ways in terms of you know, the ability to crank out animation faster and through more high-tech techniques. And so a show like this can really embrace that and do all the crazy fun stuff with the Star Trek universe that, you know, a 1970s show just really didn't have the, you know, the staff or the ability to do.
Yeah. Talking about kind of maybe the style of the show as well. What did you make of the design of the bridge?
Oh, it looked great. Like, I think it was a very good translation of sort of that majestic TNG kind of style Berman bridge. But just, you know, heightened and colorful enough, like it didn't look realistic. It had a nice, you know, animated vibe to it, but it was very representative of those bridges that we all have nostalgia for.
And you can definitely see them even building like a practical set and copying that design because it seems practical. It seems utilitarian and that it'd work and it would actually go within the Star Trek universe as we know it.
Yeah, in terms of the actual environments in which these characters are running around in, all the environments feel very, you know, kind of that classic Star Trek style. Like, they're not going crazy. It's not like, you know, wacky shaped walls and, you know, crazy doors or anything. It's very classic Star Trek architecture.
Well, the thing that jumps out to me is the corridors probably felt more like TNG than any other elements of it. And I also just like the fact that how the people on the Lower Decks have to sleep in the hallways until they rank up and get to live in an actual quarters. I had no idea that this is going on this entire time. Those poor, unfortunate souls.
No wonder Ensign Ro was so annoyed all the time.
Yeah, I would be as well. The one thing that, I did pause, but I loved the view of the ship when they get to the end of the corridor and they're able to look at the aft of the ship and it's going out to outer space. I don't quite know if the geography of that lines up with the ship design, but I didn't care. Like, it looked very majestic and it felt kind of like that's a shot that I could totally see going into a live action Star Trek show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could definitely see that. And again, it was embracing what you can do with animation, which I was very impressed. I don't know that I expected as much visually from just the pilot episode of this show than what I got. Like, it really did seem to be taking as many opportunities as it could to show us different crevices of a ship that we'd never seen before, or just visuals that would be too expensive to really cram a whole bunch of them into one episode.
Well, that's just why, like, you have to have somebody like Captain Baudet, you know, from Deep Space Nine actually make an appearance. This, of course, is the guy with the transparent skull who I don't think they had the budget to ever reproduce that for an actual appearance on Deep Space Nine. It would be amazing to get something like that in because you've got animation. It could actually work in this case.
It totally could. And I love that the aliens that they have the second contact with look like Care Bears.
Yeah. Think about how prohibitively expensive and how goofy it could have looked if they tried doing that on any other show.
Can you imagine if they did that in live action?
I would love to have seen it in TOS era.
Did you ever see the 1998 movie Avengers, you know, based on the old TV show?
It was when they're trying to control the weather.
Yeah. Did you ever see it?
No, I did not, actually.
There's a whole scene where all the villains are all dressed in giant teddy bear outfits, all different colors. That's a little bit of what this reminded me of, and that's probably what it would look like in live action if it had been done in, you know, 1989 Star Trek.
Yeah. This kind of fun that they can play with all this as well. But there's also just kind of more of the everyday sort of stuff. Like going into I love going into a captain's ready room and finding out what that tells you about the character. And with Freeman, you see like a giant sword behind her. Mm-hmm. You see like a captain's hat as if she's like the skipper from Gilligan's Island or something like that. She also has a model of the Cerritos too. So it's just interesting. I'm looking forward to find out more about Freeman and what makes her tick and that dynamic that it's going to kind of unleash with Mariner, who seems to be drunk, I would say, about what, like 40% of the episode?
Romulan whiskey, yeah.
Yeah. Why Romulan is whiskey rather than Romulan ale, Cam?
I wondered the exact same thing. I have no idea.
But it makes more sense, though, because like ale is like a beer, and they've always treated Romulan ale as if it was like a hard liquor. I like Romulan whiskey makes much more sense.
It does, yeah. I have no idea. I mean, yeah, I had no problem with it, but it did jump out kind of like, oh, I was surprised they didn't say Romulan ale, because I thought if you're going to call it something whiskey, maybe throw a different alien name in there, but whatever, it was fine.
Okay, Borg whiskey.
That's, sure.
it'll assimilate your brain, man.
That's how the Borg fund all their operations, is through the sales of Borg whiskey.
Yeah, those craft distilleries. It makes sense.
They're very efficient.
Jumping off that topic, though, I did love the design of the bar that they introduced us to. And they even have that delta with the martini olives sticking out of it, which I just thought was very cute. I think this is the best designed hangout spot that we've gotten in Star Trek yet. Like, way better than 10 Ford. The mess halls in Voyager and Discovery really never did anything for me. I think the biggest competition you have is Quark's.
I think Quark's is probably the best, though. There's so much atmosphere to that environment. It feels so unique and alien, too.
It seems so underexplored on Deep Space Nine. You really only seem to spend time around the bar. You'd occasionally get to go to the second floor. And there was a third floor that I think they just sometimes zoomed in on, but I just felt as if I never really fully was able to get the geography of Quark's. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's a fourth level, which is where they had all the holosuites. But with this bar, I wish I had a name for it. I've watched the episode twice so far. I did not catch the name either times, but in this situation, I already grasp the design. It looks busy. They obviously have the budget to fill up enough cartoon extras, unlike what they had with TNG. It looks like a place you'd actually want to hang out during your time off.
Yeah, you're damn right, though, about the filling it up and making it look like a place people actually hang out at versus the four people quietly whispering to each other in the background in 10 Ford.
I love how in 10 Ford you could always hear the engine humming in the background. It's just yep.
You really think about that. Imagine going to someplace, maybe on a ferry or something, or on just a boat, and sitting in a ballroom at a table where there's so little going on, you could just hear the engines the whole time. That is a very boring place to be.
Although, here in Vancouver, you and I alike going to dead restaurants and dead bars, just because it means we can actually hear each other speak and don't have to deal with other human beings.
We're also old, whereas these characters are young. They want to embrace life.
True. speaking of Vancouver, I don't know if you noticed this, but end credits, I didn't even think about it, but the animation was done by Titmouse Incorporated, which has a studio here in Vancouver, and you can see how at the end, in the credits, they had thanks to the government of British Columbia, blah, blah, blah. So it sounds as if they got tax credits to actually do all the animation up here in Vancouver, which is kind of cool to think about.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah, it seems like the Kurtzman era has been good for Canadian productions.
Yeah, we've got one movie, two TV shows out of it. Not bad, director at this point. But,
and we'll see. And we'll see with Strange New Worlds and Section 31. Who knows?
You keep bringing up Section 31, Cam.
I know.
I don't think it's going to happen.
At this point, it's become a fun joke just to constantly reference Section 31 as the show that is happening.
I just, I'll believe it when I see it, but it's the show no one seems excited for, but they did mention it a couple weeks ago with the Comic-Con panel. They're like, oh yeah, yeah, Section 31, that's a thing. I don't know.
I hope to be celebrating our 1,000th episode and still talking about Section 31 as a thing that's going to happen.
That'd be amazing. Just think about the fanfare for the very idea of a Captain Pike spinoff. Mm-hmm. And there's just been nothing like that for Section 31, which maybe listen to your audience, folks at CBS Viacom.
Well, I really don't have a problem with them coming up with concepts, floating them out there, and kind of reading the room. I don't think there's anything wrong with that if they see that, people don't really seem that excited, the press is very muted for it. Maybe we don't need to do this one. I wish sometimes Hollywood would do that more.
Yeah. I wouldn't you be bummed out if they pitched a Gary Mitchell spinoff, nobody reacted, but you got your hopes up for it?
I mean, it would just compete with my fan fiction, so I can't have that.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. Well, I'm still waiting for that assignment Earth pickup, that they teased us with 52 years ago. So we'll see.
Which do you think hits the screen first, that or Section 31?
It's a toss-up, honestly. It's a toss-up. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's okay, Cam. The other thing I was thinking about, though, is conventions and the potential for cosplay. I honestly think that this is going to be a show that's going to get a lot of fans excited to just like recreate these uniforms and dress up in them. Like they're cool designs. I'm not sure. I'm into the white. There's some white stripes there. I wish they kind of found something else, but I otherwise think like it's going to be fun to watch people dressed up in these.
Well, what also will be really cool is like, for example, Picard. When you see, you know, cosplayers showing up at conventions from now on, their cosplay for the uniforms of Picard are going to match what you've seen on the screen as closely as possible. Whereas with Lower Decks, there's a lot of room for interpretation in terms of the materials and everything because it's drawn with fairly simple animation. And so you're going to see the way that cosplayers approach the outfits on this show very differently. And I think that'll be really cool. And we don't really have a comparison point for that.
Well, it's a good point. You don't know this, listeners don't know this, but I am making a uniform right now and it's out of transparent mesh. So you have that to look forward to.
Mine's just body paint.
Okay, great. Good thing all the conventions have been canceled this year, people, or else that would have just been horror for everyone there.
That's right.
Yeah. The other thing that we did get to see, though, is the updated EV suits. We really haven't seen them. Well, I guess we did get to see it in Discovery, but that's from like 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it's been since First Contact, since we got kind of an update to the EV suits. So it was just cool to watch, you know, two characters. Again, the idea of like bringing characters onto the hull of the ship, having these beautiful shots, watching them walk around, you know, we got to see that with the episode Breaking the Ice on Enterprise, but like, it's an expensive proposition to do that. And again, you don't have to worry about that with animation.
Well, not only that, but when you look at shows that do those sorts of effects moments, like Discovery with Burnham doing the fly through space during the pilot, or the references you brought up there, or even in First Contact with Worf out there on the outside, you know, the Enterprise. All of those are plot specific things that had to be justified, I'm sure, when they're doing their budgeting. Whereas here, you could just have two characters. Hey, we just got to cut through, you know, over the top of the ship to go in a different door. Okay. Like, yeah. It's not tied to a specific, you know, this is going to, you know, end in a big action sequence or something. Like, you don't have to justify any of it budget-wise. You can do it whenever you want.
I love it. Yeah. Any final thoughts on what you loved about this episode before we can kind of point out some of the critiques that we might have?
Yeah. Another thing, very small point, but you and I had a conversation in the past about how the Kurtzman era has really kind of slowly opened the doors for acknowledging musical acts of the past. We've had David Bowie brought up, Al Green, I believe, on Discovery. We've had a few. Well, we can finally add the Monkees to the list.
It's what I've been waiting for. I think Patrick Stewart was pitching it hard for Star Trek Picard, and they just would not listen to the executive producer, unfortunately. But I'm glad that Mike McMahon, the creator of the show, is able to get that through finally.
I mean, I can't think of many funnier examples because they were obviously teasing into that a little bit of like, what's your favorite music? And I was just like leaning forward in my chair waiting. I'm like, it's not going to be something obvious. You know, you and I had referenced like, you know, Billy Joel or, you know, some sort of artist.
I never referenced Billy Joel, Cam. I can tell you which one. I know exactly who I did reference, though, but it was Bruce Springsteen, in which that he is one of those multi-generational artists. He's been at it for 50 years. And he's still widely respected and still putting out great music.
Give it up for Billy Joel, everybody.
Wow.
But nonetheless, you and I had talked really like racking our brains for who the basically the great artist of the 20th century would be that potentially could be mentioned in the Star Trek universe. And it never would have occurred to either of us that the Monkees would be the next one out of the gate.
Well, I think that's the joke, though.
It is the joke. It is. Yeah. It's a total joke, but it's just fun. Like, that's the thing. That's what made me laugh was not just the Monkees reference, but the idea of this being kind of the latest artist inducted into the Star Trek world.
Okay, and you bring up a very good point here. Before we get into our critiques, one final thing that I want to say, that the reason why I'm digging Lower Decks, though, is because it's having fun within the Star Trek universe. You can pull that off. You could pull off a Monkees reference in this. What if they tried to pull off a Monkees reference in Star Trek Picard? Like, that would have, like, rattled viewers in a way that people just kind of shrugged it off here.
Who's listening to the Monkees on Star Trek Picard?
Elnor. It's obvious. It's Elnor. And he singing along the entire time.
He's like riding a bathtub down the street.
Yes, yes. Thank you. But like I love that they can be playful with the universe without having to make fun of the universe. And look, if this is a sign of what's to come, I think they're only just going to kind of expand what they can do with the universe building, especially in this kind of post TNG Nemesis era. I think this is going to be a lot of fun moving forward.
By the way, Nemesis, shout out to the Dune Buggies.
Argo made its long-awaited return.
Yeah. But no, I'm on the same page with you, yeah.
Cam, this episode did commit one of those writing sins that always irk me, make me incredibly frustrated, though. And Boimler sees Mariner talking to the aliens with equipment. So instead of waiting for this thing to play out or waiting for additional context or just approaching the situation calmly, he totally freaks out. A misunderstanding ensues. He overreacts and things go bad. To me, it's just like, it's one of those things I'm just like, I'm so sick of this. This happens way too often, especially in comedies.
I know what you mean. I could go along with it though, because this character is so wound up. Like, he doesn't strike me as someone who's particularly calm and cool under pressure. And I was kind of willing to go with it for this. I mean, it felt like a bit of a leap that he would assume she's like dealing arms.
Yeah.
That was extreme, but I could believe that he would maybe be kind of sputtering and not necessarily waiting to see the ultimate resolution to a situation. It just was, I agree, though, it was a bit of a leap.
Yeah, but it did bring us to a good moment, though, and that we finally found out from Mariner that, well, she had been at Galar, I think is the name of the planet. She had been there a year before in the first contact, so she could kind of understand the needs that these alien farmers were having. It brought us to a good moment at the very least. The other thing is, you alluded to it. I just want to bring it up. The Kurtzman era of Star Trek is very busy. And I mean that just in like, it's plot point, plot point, plot point in every episode. Mm-hmm. Was this kind of on the fence there? Was this kind of pushing the boundaries about like the pace, like what is enjoyable? You are kind of like, for me, I felt as if there's a little bit of plate spinning going on. I was ultimately able to keep up with it all. It worked for me, but I'm just wondering, like, are they going to ratchet it up even further in other episodes?
I don't know. And I guess the reason that I don't really know is because this was, as you said, like a very fast-paced 24 minutes. Like, characters were never stopped, like, spouting dialogue. Like, it was rapid fire. But it was also, a lot of the dialogue was aimed at establishing who all the characters were and what their world was in a pilot. So I'm really looking forward to episode 2 to see how the episode deals with more of a standalone story versus we have to introduce like 4 characters plus the supporting cast plus the ship and all that sort of stuff.
The only thing that I noticed though is like the cast is quite large, and I think they're going to have kind of the A story with the Lower Decks folks, and you're going to have the B story with, you know, the command crew. I just wonder if that lends itself naturally to being like quite stuffed, quite busy episode to episode, and you're going to have like a lot of these very fast-paced sorts of events, which I like kind of the chill factor. Although I say that, and I don't know if Boimler is the one to bring the chill factor.
I suspect this will be a faster-paced Star Trek, and I think this was probably representative of the tone we'll be getting week to week, and probably the speed.
Yeah,
but I do think that if we can focus more just on what the individual story of the episode is, or the A and the B story, without all the introduction stuff, it might make it a little bit smoother. I mean, you can imagine just the heavy lifting that goes into writing like a 24-minute rapid-fire sitcom, animated sitcom, and introducing a whole like host of characters. Like, it would be very stressful. So I'm hoping also that in the future that it's not necessarily every episode is an ensemble episode. We can focus on one character and bounce around the way that like TNG did, for example.
Yeah. So Kim, maybe we can kind of shift, or unless you have another critique that you'd like to share, but do you want to shift over to how this kind of ranks as kind of a series premiere amongst Star Trek shows?
Yeah, I think I'm good for critiques. Yeah, let's move on to that.
Okay, so I think to me that this is far and away the best series premiere in the Kurtzman era, in that they clearly establish who all the main characters are. They clearly establish what the premise of the series is. And this is all done in 24 minutes. You and I have been very frustrated with Discovery and Picard, in that, you know, we're we're 4 or 5 episodes into season one of Picard, and we had just met all of the main characters by that point. And the producers kept telling us it's a 10-hour movie, as if we're like idiots and like we should just shut up and embrace it. The other thing that frustrated me more so than you though is like Star Trek Discovery didn't have a premise throughout seasons 1 and 2. It's just people on a ship that it didn't really differentiate itself. But now we know that the ship lost some time right away. This just kind of exceeds everything that we saw with like, you know, those first episodes of Picard and Discovery respectively.
Well, I think it helps too that you had Mike McMahon overseeing this. You know, he worked on Rick and Morty for a long time and he's got a lot of veterans of animation working with him. So they know how to put together an animated show that kind of hits all the necessary points that to establish what your premise is very quickly. Whereas I did feel like with Discovery, you had, you know, Brian Fuller leaving early and it felt like a lot of kind of feeling around in the dark trying to establish what that show was for a little bit. And same with Picard, like both of them, Picard, I think was a little more confident in terms of the pilot having a tone that does lend itself to the rest of the series. After the Discovery pilot, you and I were like, what is this show about?
We're like, well, we enjoyed those 2 hours, but we don't know what this series is about. And mm-hmm. Guess what? They didn't really establish any sort of premise for the series. Like, you don't go into a pitch meeting with executives and give them like a half sentence pitch. And essentially it's like, yeah, it's about a Klingon war. The executives are like, well, that's not a premise though. So Discovery's kind of found its way. We were very excited for season 3. Picard, I don't know. What Cam, what is Picard about?
Well, I guess it's about, Captain Picard, or the former Captain Picard, finding new meaning in the near the end of his life.
Sure, that sounds exciting. It's like that is not a premise. That is not a pitch you go in with executives. You go to an executive and say, "Hey, we want to do an animated comedy show about a ship that specializes in second contacts, and we're going to focus on kind of the grunts of Starfleet." Boom. That's it right there. Like Picard, the best way I can sum it up is guy searches for friend's robot daughter. Like,
right.
Okay. It's like,
do you think that that's what they approached them though in terms of Picard? Because I know the initial pitch wasn't really used. Sold it off I know what you mean. Like you're just establishing
I'm
what
kind
the
of
show
reverse,
is.
Reverse engineering at yeah. this point, you know, so.
Yeah. But do you think when they actually approached the network, they just gave the original pitch and then changed it through development?
I think what they did with the network, they said, Patrick Stewart has agreed to come back and reprise the character of Jean-Luc Picard. And the studio is like, sure, let's do it. Mm, like, I honestly think that's what it was. And so that's why I think it's problematic. If like you don't have like a full idea of what your show is supposed to be, it's like you're putting things in backwards. You're almost reverse engineering a premise to fit around something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea with the Discovery though, is it was supposed to be an anthology series, which that would have made a much more sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that would have been really, I think, interesting. Although the only thing about the anthology is, and I don't know, maybe I'm just overthinking this, but I wonder if, when they're looking at a new Star Trek show as the first one out of the gate, they're looking to bring in new fans and they thought maybe an anthology might lose people who are new Star Trek fans. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I think actually nowadays in current TV, the anthology series, they're actually better for grabbing fans because they know that they don't have to put in, you know, like a 6-year commitment to this. And that's why anthology series have been extremely popular in the last, you know, 5-6 years. I think the real issue though was the expense of having to recast and perhaps having to redo a lot of these sets. Presumably it would have been like showing different generations of crews on a ship called Discovery. Maybe it started with like Discovery and then it had to go to the Discovery A and B after, you know, hundreds of years, who knows, but that's my best guess about what happened there.
That would have been an interesting idea. I wonder if that's something we are more likely to get further down the road versus the first show out of the Kurtzman gate.
Yes, I think that's a very good point though, because maybe it just would have felt risky if they, look, this is early with CBS saying like, oh, we need to have a streaming service. Do we want to go out of the gate with an anthology series, or do we want to ensure that we're going to have people coming back season after season after season because they're invested in these characters? Whereas they could just easily do, you know, 13 episodes and then call it quits after that.
Right. It would be kind of like if the Berman era had started with Deep Space Nine. It's kind of like, yeah. Oh, like people are tuning in because they want to see a ship, and now you're just not, you're on a station. Like, people were angry enough about it as it was.
Yeah, no kidding. Still talk to Marina Sirtis, and she's still calling it a gas station in space. And just like, she said that at a convention a couple years ago, and she got all these boos. And she seemed like a pro wrestler, and like her hands were waving in the air, like, bring it on, bring it on. Like, she loved that sort of attention. So.
Here's the question. Do you think Marina Sirtis has sat and watched any Deep Space Nine?
No.
Yeah, I don't either.
Not one lick of it. So, yeah, okay, maybe a kind of a fun game here. Is Second Contact better or worse than The Man Trap? What's a stronger series premiere?
Than The Man Trap? Oh, like The Man Trap is hugely iconic. It doesn't necessarily establish the relationships as well as this seems to. It's very difficult for me to say, obviously, having only seen one episode of Lower Decks, but it would seem to establish the relationships between the characters very well. I have so much fondness for The Man Trap, I hate to say that this is better than The Man Trap, but I think if you were just to look at it without any of my nostalgia or love for the original series, just as on paper, what establishes the premise and the characters better, I would say this does, because I don't think The Man Trap does a great job at establishing what the original series was all about, which really was about going to strange new worlds. I mean, that one, you don't really do that.
Yeah, if I'm just being clinical about it, I think that this is a stronger series premiere. It does the job of a series premiere better than The Man Trap. Better or worse, Encounter at Farpoint or Second Contact?
I mean, aside from the great Q stuff, I don't know that there's that much to recommend it. So I would say this is better than Encounter at Farpoint.
What about Emissary?
Yeah, well, Emissary is interesting because I actually think Emissary does a very good job establishing the world of Deep Space Nine.
The characters,
Sisko's journey, what is going to carry him through much of, you know, the seven seasons. I would say I think probably Emissary is better. Emissary has a huge advantage, though, being significantly longer and allowing us to spend a lot more time with the characters. And by the time we reach the end of that story, we have much more of a sense of who they are as individuals and where the show could go.
Yeah, I agree with you for the reasons that you laid out, but I also wonder how influenced I am by just knowing that I had this journey with all those characters, and maybe that's one of the reasons why I'm favoring Emissary over Second Contact. But what about Caretaker?
Well, I think Caretaker, basically everything I said about Deep Space Nine, Caretaker does it an extra step better. So yeah. Caretaker is better than Emissary, and it's better than the Lower Decks premiere.
We've talked about it before. I think we both agree that Caretaker, say what you want about Voyager, whether it's your favorite series or least favorite series, I think it's still the strongest series premiere that Star Trek has delivered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cam, Broken Bow.
This is an interesting one because Broken Bow is a little bit further down, but I think Broken Bow, I would still give the edge because it has a lot of the grandeur of Star Trek, you know, the whole launching of the NX-01 that I think really captures like the spirit of what you want from that series going forward and pulls you into an adventure story that I think is very involving. So I would say that Broken Bow is also superior, but I would say it's closer to Lower Decks.
Yeah, yeah. And then you and I, we both agree that's, you know, the Vulcan Hello as well as Remembrance below, or, well, I don't know. What would you say? Better or worse than Second Contact?
I would say below Second Contact.
It's just like they don't really establish what those shows are about from the outset. And as a series premiere, that's what you need to do. Look, in Star Trek Picard, we only meet like one main character, or maybe two or three if you count the tail end of Narek and Soji at the very, very last 30 seconds of the episode.
Exactly. I mean, I remember walking out of, after we recorded the podcasts for those two pilots, walking out just kind of scratching my head being like, what is this show going to be?
I think we would put Second Contact middle of the pack, and it's not because it's a bad or like a middling sort of series premiere. It's mostly just because of the strength of, you know, some of the other shows, though. So, that, you know, that's all.
And also, pilots are rarely anyone's favorite episode of a series.
I don't know, man. The pilot episode of Seinfeld is mine.
You know what? I'm glad you brought up Seinfeld, because I actually had a little bit of a flashback to Seinfeld. I really enjoyed how they tied the A and the B stories together in a big kind of culmination of everything in Lower Decks. I mean, this was a little rougher around the edges than what Seinfeld really did at its best, where it was a very graceful, you know, dovetailing of the two stories together. But I'm hoping to see more of that, where the A and the B actually have a relationship together by the end of the story.
I think that's probably going to be par for the course for the show, though. I think that's what they want to aim to do. It's just like, well, the bridge crew is dealing with kind of the big stuff. We're going to be following these Lower Decks crews on like kind of the impacts of like how that is impacting them and how they have to do a lot of that grunt work.
It also means that both stories matter, because, you know, you think of some of the lesser B stories in Star Trek, the one you like to reference with Hoshi having to go around and find out Reed's favorite type of food, and it's pineapples. I mean, that is a throwaway kind of nothing B story. I mean, it has a bit of character development, but when you look at a synopsis of what that episode's about, you are completely ignoring that B story. Yes. Whereas when you look at this episode and you see a synopsis, you have a sense, if you've seen it, as to why these two stories matter and what the connection is between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. So Cam, look, I think this is a great way to kick it off. We have no fears about moving forward with the show. We're not scratching our heads. We enjoyed our time. We were anticipating this series, I think, more than, say, Star Trek Picard and all the talk about Star Trek Section 31. It lived up to expectations. I was not disappointed with what we got.
We were very optimistic about this one. I think more so than a lot of other people were, at least the vocal people. But it delivered enough to me that I was, let's put it this way, when it was over, I didn't kind of hang my head a bit and go like, oh, like I was a little off on this one. I felt like, okay, this did deliver what I was hoping for, and I'm looking forward to, you know, hunkering down over the next 9 episodes to come and learning more about the characters. And basically, once I'm now familiar with the world of the show, being able to relax a little bit and just follow them on their adventures.
I also just like the 24-minute length of this. Like, I think it's kind of perfect for what they're trying to accomplish here.
Yeah. Do you think we'll see more experimentations in the form? I mean, obviously we have Star Trek Prodigy coming up, but is there many other avenues for the Kurtzman era to take Star Trek? Because we have, you know, the kind of the Discovery and the Picard series. We've got this wacky animated show. We've got a kid show. Is there many more ways for them to go that feel radically different?
Yes, Cam. Puppets. Puppets in space.
Hey, I would be 100% for that.
I would too. I'm serious. I'd love a puppet show. You know.
Yeah. So we have a voicemail that came in, actually, from friend of the show, Scott Hardy, with his thoughts on Lower Decks. Let me just play those.
Hey, guys. Scott Hardy here, beaming in from sunny old London, England. Just wanted to share my thoughts on the Lower Decks premiere. Now, you guys know I've been really excited about this show. I even chased Mike McMahon down in Vegas last year to get his autograph on his TNG Season 8 book. So I'm a fan of his work. I like Rick and Morty. I saw the trailer a few months back, and I'll be honest, I was kind of skeptical. I didn't laugh at some of the jokes, and it seemed like it's just something I wouldn't really want to watch. But I went ahead and watched the premiere, and I have to say, I loved it. I cared about the characters. I laughed at the right bits, I think. And yeah, I'm looking forward to next week. I want to give a shout out to Rutherford. I think his character would be someone I resonate a little bit with that sort of awkward feel to him. And I have a feeling that Lieutenant Shax is basically a Worf stand-in, because the amount of times he wants to just fire phasers and isn't allowed to. Anyway, just wanted to share my thoughts. Stay safe, guys. Peace.
Wow, I'm incredibly impressed that Scott Hardy was able to see the trailer a couple months ago. Wow, I wish I had the connections that Scott does, but unfortunately I only got to see it a couple weeks ago. But
right.
Maybe I'm just being a jerk. Maybe I'm being the Jerry O'Connell character, the Commander Ransom at this point.
But, yeah, that's right.
Actually, Scott brings up something kind of a cool story that we have to share, though. But at that same convention that Scott got to track down the creator of the show, you and I, we tracked down two of the writers because they both used to be contestants on the reality TV show Survivor. They were both like master narrators of what was going on throughout their seasons. And it's not shocking to us that we'd find them writing for a comedy series such as this. And so John Cochran, David Wright, you'll see their names in the credits. It was just cool to meet up with them. They couldn't have been nicer to us. And yeah, that was so much fun.
Mm-hmm. It was, yeah. And like their involvement was a bit of a confidence booster for me as well. Just knowing what funny guys they are, you know, it was just very exciting. And to know that they were going to be affiliated with this, it made me want to watch the show that much more.
Yes, yes.
So if you want to hear more from Scott, he's actually launching his own podcast where he's going to be tackling spy movies. And it's going to be called Spy Hards. And it will have a certain co-host you may recognize.
Well, that's weird because I don't recall being asked to co-host this with him. But okay, I'm up for anything, Scott.
That's right. So you can check your podcasts everywhere, wherever you get your podcasts. Spy Hards, it'll be up in the next week or so. So you got that to look forward to. But anyways, yeah. So thanks for the input, though, Scott. And yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to... I mean, I don't know when we're having conventions again, Tyler. It's a very depressing thought to even bring up.
2021.
Yeah. But I am looking forward to a future where we can have more involvement with a show like Lower Decks, because it does feel so much different than what we get with, say, like some of the Discovery or the Picard panels. You know, we obviously hadn't seen a lot of Picard panels yet, but it'll just have a different energy. And to have some of the voice actors out there doing panels, I think you'll get a lot less of the, what I feel like a lot of the live action actors have to do, a lot of talk about, we are here to embrace the wonder of what Gene Roddenberry created. You know, I think we can have a little more fun, yeah, and some irreverent panels and get some of these writers out there talking about the crazy ideas they've got or ones that were rejected and just really having fun doing panels.
Kev, I never need to go to another panel where somebody wants to talk about Gene Roddenberry's vision. It's like... I've heard it. We're good.
Yeah,
it's been
exactly.
4 years, you know, we're okay.
Exactly. Like, bring some irreverence to these panels. I think that could be a lot of fun too. Hopefully it's soon.
What is the market going to be like for photo ops with these voice actors though?
I don't know that it's going to be great. There's the actress whose name I'm blanking on. I believe her first name was Julia, wasn't it? Who does the voice of the computer on Star Trek Discovery.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but she came to the convention, and she did very well actually recording voicemails for people.
Oh, okay.
And she was doing those at her table, and she was actually a blast. She put on a really fun panel. She appeared with a few other people, but like she was just a ball of energy. She was so much fun. So, I mean, these you know, people doing animated voices could actually clean up pretty well, I think, doing voicemails.
Well, I'm going to ask the Mariner actress to say, computer, all nude Olympic training facility, please.
And it will be completely unrelated to the show.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Let us know what you thought of the first episode of Lower Decks. I know it's a little polarizing out there, so we want to hear some thoughts on what you thought of the show. Tyler, I guess next week we're doing episode 2 of Lower Decks. Okay, so you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Voracious Milk Spider, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nude Olympic Training Facility.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.